good guy, too.
Then I can be more.
Trying to get it through for the verbal.
We call to order. Any member of the public may speak on any item which is on the agenda. If a member of the public wishes to speak on a particular item or during the public comment, a public comment form must be completed. At the beginning of the regular agenda, during the public comment, the public may address matters under the jurisdiction of the board that are not on the posted agenda. Any person wishing to make a presentation must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all board members. Presentations will be limited to 3 minutes at the chair's discretion. Comments may be further limited if additional comments are substantially similar to comments already made. That's the public comment. Roll comments.
Okay, Marie DeAmbitt.
Here.
Ron Martin.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Clarence Willman. Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Lynn Betancourt. Darren Garrett.
Here.
Linda Stoss Burnett.
Here.
And Mike Fisher. We have a quorum.
Hey. Thank you, Tom. Announcements. I have one. Tom, I would like to present to you. Sorry about that there.
That's all right.
I would like to present to you. I'm flattered. Celebrating 30 years of service to the county. So congratulations on 30 years of service.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Your combat infantry badge is next.
I didn't have that black purple heart.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So thank you. So any further announcements? Okay, public comment. Seeing none. Consent items.
I'll make a motion to approve the consent items.
Second.
Okay. Motion and second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. Okay. So moved.
Sure.
Okay. Oh, I'm gonna say okay. I'm throwing it on. SIS.
Thank you.
Got a few items here.
Yes, we do. We'd like to start out first kind of giving an overview on why we're here today and then going through the items. As a follow-up from the last couple of financial meetings, and at the last meeting we had an education session by KKR on a couple of areas, mezzanine debt and infrastructure, the continued turmoil in the equity markets and the potential to further de-risk the portfolio from an equity standpoint. We are here, first of all, to go through some asset projections, where we add a couple new asset classes to the mix from what we've been showing the last few months. And on page 2, the summary projection highlighted in blue on the right, we have added mezzanine debt and infrastructure as asset classes with expected risk and returns to our model. Quickly, mezzanine debt has an expected return of 11% on a net basis with a standard deviation or risk of 8%. And this was gathered by using high yield as a proxy for the mezzanine debt returns with a slight increase in the return due to the liquidity factor, and volatility is set at 70% volatility of the high yield.
Could you define the high yield a little more?
Excuse me?
Could you explain what you mean by high yield?
Yeah, high yield are bonds that are below investment grade. The proxy is a Merrill Lynch High Yield Master 2 Index, which tracks these bonds. And they tend to have higher coupons than investment grade bonds due to the quality being lower and higher volatility than investment grade
bonds.
Are
they also longer term? Or?
Yeah, these are these expectations are set for 7 years for all asset classes, and high yield are all corporate bonds.
Well, I mean, they're 7 year corporate bonds. They're longer corporate.
No, no, they vary in they'll vary in their duration and in the when the bonds mature. They'll vary all across the spectrum. They'll have a longer duration than the BC, the Barclays Capital Aggregate, which is the core fixed income aggregate.
So part of the reason there's a higher return is there a little longer investment?
Yes, that would be part of it. Exactly right.
Okay.
But I think the main part is the lower quality aspect. Infrastructure has an expected return of 8% with a standard deviation of 9. And infrastructure expected returns are taken off of publicly traded equities, which are considered infrastructure. They would include energy pipelines, water, gas, utility type of publicly traded equities, and transportation also. We try to be conservative on the expected returns on these. The group that did the education last month had higher expected returns, but for modeling purposes and just our nature, we wanted to be conservative on the returns of those type of vehicles. Page 3 is the correlation we've seen before on the existing asset classes. And the next page, page 4, we add a correlation metric for mezzanine debt and infrastructure to the model also. Obviously, part of the attraction of adding new asset classes is, and the goal would be to add new asset classes that have lower correlations to the existing asset classes of a plan to get the diversification benefits. And you can see mezz debt and infrastructure to the existing asset classes that StampServer is already invested in, and they have a 0.48 correlation to one another. So the model is going to like these two asset classes first because the expected returns of 8 and 9% respectively for infrastructure at 8 and mezz debt at 9 and the correlation benefits, and then with fairly low standard deviations given the level of expected returns for each. Page 5 looks at the current target mix today as we presented the last couple of times. The target portfolio using our latest assumptions has an expected return of 7.2% and a standard deviation of just under 11%. And page 6 was the table we presented last at the end of last month also, looking at the target portfolio within mixes of just the existing asset classes where we don't add anything new to it. And it increases fixed income at the expense of equities, U.S. equities, that is, kind of across the board, with the exception of mix 1C, the one on the far right kind of mirrors the allocation of fixed income. And you can see adding additional assets to core fixed income at the expense of U.S. equities will lower the expected risk. However, the expected return will also go down, as one would expect, given the expected return for core fixed income is at 3.9%. Okay. Page 7 is the new page where we take the existing asset classes and we add mezzanine debt and infrastructure as new asset classes to it. And as I said, the model's going to like these asset classes given the relatively high expected return versus risk and the correlation benefits from the two asset classes. And you can see mix 1 keeps the expected return right at 720 versus the current target portfolio. But the expected risk drops by 91 basis points by adding 3% to infrastructure, 3% to mezz debt, and 2.2% to real estate, which is currently at 1.5%. You can see the ranges we use for each of the asset classes. And there is a large reduction in equity from U.S. equity and international equity in this run in mix one. And core fixed income goes up slightly also, with mezz debt taking the full 3% as does infrastructure. We added three more mixes. The model on mixes 2, 3, and 4 takes a full 3% to mezz debt, infrastructure, and real estate for a total of 9% allocated combined to those three asset classes. And U.S. equity and international equity are each reduced, with mix 4 having the least reduction in those current equity asset classes. Fixed income in, is also reduced slightly, the core fixed income in mixes 2, 3, and 4. The mix 4 has the highest expected return at 7.4%, yet still the expected risk is reduced by roughly 25 basis points to 10.69%. In mix 4, U.S. equity is reduced to 38% from 41.4%. An international 15 from 16, while emerging is kept at 4% across. So we have 38 U.S. equity, 19 international, or 57%, versus the current 61.4%. U.S. core fix is reduced by roughly 3%, which more or less would fund the mezzanine debt, which is another part of fixed income. And then infrastructure is added at 3%, and real estate is increased at 1.5%. So a total addition of 4.5%, which is taken from U.S. equity at 3.4%, international at 1%. I will take a break there.
And I'd still like to go back and understand the difference between your proxy and mezzanine debt. The proxy is a Merrill Lynch, what, bond fund?
The proxy is a high yield fund.
Okay.
The proxy for mezzanine debt is high yield.
Okay. Now on
and high yield as a index, we use the Merrill Lynch High Yield Index, which is a widely filed index for high yield from a passive standpoint. But the proxy for mezzanine debt is the high yield index, but at a 70% volatility because. The nature of private, being private mezzanine debt and pricing, just the volatility is much less than the public markets in high yield.
So in other words, if you had a different category on your listing, which was the proxy itself, you would have the same expected return, but at a different risk factor or something?
Yeah, I mean, if the category was U.S. high yield, the proxy would be the same, Merrill Lynch High Yield Master. The expected return would be less, and the standard deviation would be slightly higher.
Okay, and those differences are because the private equity, you feel, has less volatility?
Less fluctuation in pricing, exactly, by its private nature and just by the way mezzanine debt operates versus high yield debt. And then... the expected return is higher because the coupons are higher for mezzanine debt versus high yield.
Okay. And then the administrative costs on your proxy would be less expensive. It's just a fund you buy into? Where in the mezzanine you pay a fee for being part of?
Right. The proxies themselves are passive, so the expenses are virtually nil.
Okay.
For the expected returns... in this case, mezzanine debt, we took in consideration of presenting net type of returns, given there are fees. So on a gross basis, you would gross that 11% up to some level. And as I said, we also want to be conservative in our expected return there. KKR, for example, came in and said they would expect a low to mid-teens net return in this class. We're presenting 11% just to be...
But they have a fee, I believe, of 1% off the top?
Well, their expected return of the low to mid-teens was on a net basis, they were saying. So they would expect a mid to upper-teen return on a gross basis before fees.
What kind of a measure do you have to judge that?
You mean from a benchmark perspective?
Yeah, I mean, you know, most of the stuff we've been dealing with have a lot of benchmarks, stocks, bonds, that kind of stuff. We're moving in a category that doesn't have a lot of benchmarks, right? Which is why you get a proxy.
Right. I think there's two ways to go on that. One way would be to assign them an absolute return. You know, 9-10% on an annual basis would be an absolute return as a benchmark. A second would be to assign them, for example, this high yield benchmark plus 300 to 500 basis points of additional performance.
Yeah, I mean, generally in private equity, you can go a couple of routes. You can say, in terms of, to Paul's point, you can use a public index. So you can use the S&P 500 or S&P 1500 and add 300 to 500 basis points over that. Or if you want to get specific to an asset class like mezzanine, generally speaking, mezzanine returns are not going to vary all that much if the manager is doing their job. So the returns on a net basis should probably fall within a spectrum of, say, anywhere from 11-13% net to the investor. Because it is a fixed income instrument, you're not taking there's not a whole lot of optionality as far as the equity is concerned. So essentially, you're just collecting the coupon. And the coupons have remained fairly static over time. They haven't changed or varied all that much. So what we do on the private equity side when we take a look at mezzanine is, for some clients, we either measure it, you know, against a public benchmark plus, like I said, some sort of nominal return over the public benchmark, or we just, there is a sub-asset class within private equity. We use a database called Venture Economics that has mezzanine funds in there, and we compare returns to those mezzanine funds.
Okay. And like most things, there's a trade-off, so you get a higher return, but you lose what, liquidity?
Yeah, you lose liquidity, and you get a higher return and below investment grade type of instruments.
So you got a little higher risk on the investment.
And a lower quality.
But you also have a liquidity issue. Like this proxy, I assume you get in and out every day. It's just a fund to buy into or get out of.
The index itself on the Merrill Lynch High Yield Masters based off of public markets, so you could get in.
I mean, so you buy it today, you sell it tomorrow, whatever.
Right.
We're on the mezzanine, you're going to lock in for some period of time.
Exactly right.
Okay.
And that's the illiquidity premium that you demand over the public benchmark of 300 to 500 basis points.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So the last page, page 8, obviously when you add new asset classes to a mix, and these new asset classes have diversification benefits with expected returns and risks that compare favorably, as I said, just keeping mix one has the same expected return of 7.2% and lowers the expected risk from 10.93 to 10.02%. That's one of the two areas of magic in our investment industry. One is compounding interest, although that magic's basically disappeared with where short-term rates are today. And the second is the magic genie of diversification, of adding different asset classes that uncorrelate, which push up your expected returns from the efficient frontier of the existing asset classes that you have. Mixes 2, 3, and 4 are all viable mixes on the efficient frontier, as presented on page 7 with the new asset classes of mezzanine debt and infrastructure. Mix 4 gives you the highest return at 7.4%, still lowers the expected risk, and takes roughly 4.4% away from equities from the current 41.4 U.S. equity and 20 international equity. It's the least disruptive, I guess you could say, of all the mixes. Mixes 1 is more conservative, and mix 2, 3, and 4 get a little more aggressive on the efficient frontier with these two new asset classes. So, I mean, when you look at mix 1, I mean, in our world, this is excitement when you get a model telling you the expected return is expected to be at the same level while reducing risk by almost a full percentage point from a standard deviation standpoint. Again, this is a model, and we saw what happened to models in 2008 when the financial crisis roared its ugly head. But intuitively, if one wants to further de-risk the portfolio from an equity standpoint and lower the standard deviation, adding mezzanine debt and infrastructure the way we have modeled it is a big plus versus the current target portfolio without those two asset classes. Real estate, the global real estate portfolio would go up over time to 3%. We have memos on each of the three asset classes following this with real estate, the global REIT allocation in Invesco, and mezzanine debt and infrastructure with the KKR products. Obviously, filling the mezzanine debt, infrastructure, and real estate, because of their nature, will take a little time to fill them, fill that 3% if one went that route. It does make sense from a efficient frontier standpoint to consider that.
And the money would come out, having said that, the money would come out from these various funds to fund that. But if it takes a while to establish, what happens? Do we just wait to pull the money until we have a product available?
You have two choices there. One is what you just described, that as capital calls are made in infrastructure and mezzanine debt, you could use, in this example, depending on the mix, but if mix four was chosen, you could use Dodge & Cox core fixed income to fund mezzanine debt as capital calls are made. And then you can use the existing primarily U.S. equity managers, large cap, and then to a lesser extent, the two small cap managers and international equity to fund capital calls and infrastructure and, at the appropriate time, real estate. We've asked Invesco to work with us to alert us when they feel is a better time to invest in REITs, and we'll get into that in the memo. So we don't envision that happening right away, but at some point in the future, when they feel REITs are more attractive and we agree, then we can pull the trigger and take money out of the equity managers to fund that additional REIT. The other option is, if one wanted to move out of equities right away, would be to move into cash or something and keep that money in cash until you get those calls made.
Or your proxy?
I prefer the first scenario that Maria described.
Gentleman first. Actually, I'm speaking for a gentleman. I got a comment from Clarence in his absence. He did state that I won't jump ahead to item 6C, but for item 6B, he stated a preference for mix one. So having said that,
okay. Can we look at the overall picture? Because I have a hard time doing one thing at a time.
Yep.
The poor multitasker.
Yes. First of all, I like mix four best. And we can talk about that. But I think that offers us the highest return, minimizes our equities across the board.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And I don't think they're... I don't know that we're prepared to bet on any equity class at this point in time. I think they're all going to suffer throughout the world. And it does increase our expected risk over some of the other mixes, but it lowers them as compared to what we are today. What I'd like to see us do is fund all three of these categories to the 3%. Which means adding an additional $15 million to Invesco when the time is right.
Right.
Although we're never going to pick the bottom, so I think we have to kind of hedge in here how much we're going to lose in equities or how much potential we may lose in equities versus relatively stagnant in real estate REITs at this point in time. Realizing there is some upside, but I don't, that could be 2 or 3 years down the road. So I think it's a long-term play also. The mezzanine, as I understand it from KKR's presentation, they have a candidate in mind right now that we would be going into that fund, and that's more of an eminent funding if we go with that one.
I think my sense, first of all, I agree with Mix 4. As far as infrastructure, I mean, as far as mezzanine debt, I think the opportunity today is very compelling, and I would prefer to move quicker than slower, given where current, you know, coupons are and just that opportunity.
Right.
I think that opportunity will be there for many years out, but it behooves us to move fairly quickly, whether it's with KKR or another fund. And we'll get into the specifics of the individual managers in the memo. But I think that's something that would be called fairly quickly by, you know, KKR or whoever that might be.
And I mean, we can look at other funds, but to me, they're the dominant leader in this field. They have been for many, many years. They have a good track record. And
our memo supports that.
Yeah, and I think those, you know, I mean, those are important right. issues when we look at that. And lastly is the infrastructure. I think we also ought to put $30 million into that at this point. I think we need to examine other alternatives.
Yes.
Because, as you stated, and I agree, I think, you know, they're looking at one project, and I think we need diversification on the infrastructure.
Right. And I think we've met with a fund-to-fund manager in infrastructure will give us more diversification across 4 or 5 firms, and we'll try to bring them in September maybe and then look at other individual funds. But I think, you know, if we choose one, if we add mezzanine debt and infrastructure, our sense would that would be part of the special situations portfolio along with the global REITs, funding at 3% fully or whatever is decided. We'll change the guidelines to reflect that on whatever mix is chosen. And I think the big picture plan would be to provide diversification to give us equity-like returns in these new asset classes at much lower volatility and low correlation to equities, which excites me. And you know, timing-wise would be, you know, based on the memos we present, would be to work with KKR and, you know, potentially verbally giving them a commitment of $30 million. Continue to work with Invesco and, you know, determine when is the time to put in 15 or part of the 15 on a, you know, going forward basis. And then infrastructure, KKR themselves just told me in the last call they don't expect to close to the end of September. So we can go back to them on some of the issues we have with them. And meanwhile, we would, if we went that route with KKR and infrastructure, we wouldn't give them the whole $30 million. We'd give them part of that and then look to add a second manager, maybe the fund of funds or something, which we could present in September.
And their minimum was $10 million, wasn't it?
Yes.
So, Ron, you want Mix 4, but you want to change and increase the money. Is that correct?
No, I want Mix 4.
Okay.
And those are 3% levels, so we're basically talking $30 million in each category.
And you recommend Mix 4?
Yes. We agree with Ron in that area.
I just think that gives us the best return with the least or a more levered risk factor. And it does give us a diversification. I think one thing we saw when the market crashes, we lack diversification. We were in equities and fixed income, and they both got hammered at the same time. And we just had nothing. And again, we're only talking these three levels, right? 9%. It's a small. It's not going to save our bacon, but it's going to minimize any hurt on the downside. And there is potential for better upside.
And the, you know, it's still a very, very liquid portfolio. We're only putting 6% essentially into illiquid type of assets. So you're still 94% liquid. And the other point was during that huge period of duress, our, as we remember, our fixed income manager acted like equities given their high corporate allocation. We mitigated that somewhat by adding PIMCO, which has a very different portfolio, heavily in governments now. So that's good. And we would propose as MIG 4 is adopted that the reduction in fixed income would come from Dodge and Cox, that whole three.
The one comments that I had regarding the mixes, because I do like the higher, again, the higher return with, we're still getting, again, the least, less of a risk. But really, in looking at this, one of the things that we decided earlier on, not that we can't change our mind, is that we wanted to maintain some level of funding or increase the fixed income. So in mix, I was actually leaning more towards mix 3, but it's so similar to mix 4 that it's really splitting hairs.
Well, I think you have to add mezzanine debt to core fixed income for total fixed income allocation. So if you do that, mix 4 is essentially the same as the current mix.
Okay. Okay.
That's how I reason out of that one. My problem is that we already have 37.1% in core fixed income. Rates, the 10-year is now at 270, believe it or not, today. And it's not to say it can't go to 2%, because it could, but the expected return now from just a income level on the Barclay area, it's got to be in the low threes now, or maybe 3.5%. And I'd rather not add more funds to that type of asset class, given we already have 37.1%, and that's my feeling. I want to further diversify it. I want to consider further de-risking the portfolio from an equity standpoint, but I don't want to put more into core fixed income given the low expected returns and where interest rates are. And we all. And we'll still have over a third of the portfolio in that bucket.
How long is the money tied up?
It's for a long while. Mezzanine debt, it could be up to 12 years, and infrastructure up to 15 years. Now, for each of those asset classes and vehicles, though, you are getting thrown back on an annual basis large cash flows, as Herschel said, if the manager does their job, with mezzanine debt throwing off, around 10% a year in cash back to the fund, and infrastructure, 8 to 10%. So you are tied up, but you should get immediately a return on the invested capital.
Does that stay in the infrastructure fund?
No, it will go out to us.
So technically that cash could be used to pay monthly, for example, monthly benefits,
yes,
as opposed to taking it out from other funds.
Right. Very much so, yes. Okay. Yeah.
What is the contractual lock? Is it between us and the firm or what?
It's between us and the GP?
Yeah, between you and the partnership, which is controlled by the general partner.
So when we sign up, we say this is a lock for 12 years, whatever time frame it is.
Yeah, I mean, generally the term structure of these things is it's a 10-year structure, and then the general partner, in this case it would be KKR, they have the right to extend out the term by, 1 or 2 years, depending on what's left in the portfolio. Generally what happens is you get past 10 years, and then effectively they exercise the right to extend the term by additional 1 year, and they do that they do that for roughly, you know, 2 or 3 years until the portfolio is fairly liquid. They've gotten everything. They've gotten rid of everything that's inside the portfolio. With mezzanine securities, generally what happens is because there is a callable feature in there, right now the terms are such that there is a non-call in place, whereas effectively the issuer can't call the security back for at the minimum 3 years. But generally, you know, when rates do become attractive in terms of where they are right now with lower rates, and the issuer can go back out and refinance, the security itself will be called back after, say, 3 years or whatnot. So with the mezzanine fund, more than likely the term structure will stay at 10 years. That's what I'm trying to communicate.
Okay, so let me see if I understand. It's a fund of things they're purchasing. They go out and buy these purchase instruments, which they can buy and sell or change?
Yeah, they don't buy the purchase. So what mezzanine is that effectively it's a private security. So you hear about these leverage buyouts, these transactions.
Okay.
So you got an equity sponsor, just to make things simple. Let's say it's KKR.
Okay.
And actually, theoretically, you don't want this to be the case, but just for simplicity's sake, let's say it's KKR, the main buyout fund, which is Henry Kravis operates. So they go out and they want to buy XYZ company. That's a private company. Let's say it's a $1 billion company, meaning the purchase price is going to be $1 billion. Generally speaking, what they do to finance that $1 billion transaction in the current market, they would probably put in roughly 40% equity, so $400 million would go in of their own money, and they would borrow the balance. In the past, back during the bubble days, if you will, banks were more than happy to lend roughly out of that $600 million, roughly, say, $400 million, and the other $200 million would come from these so-called mezzanine providers.
Okay.
Now, banks have actually cut back quite a bit, and so you've got this big gap in terms of who actually is going to finance a lot of these transactions. So banks now, instead of supplying maybe 4/10 of the capital or supplying maybe 2/10 of the capital, the mezzanine guys, they're still being somewhat conservative. During the heyday, during the bubble days, they were probably supplying maybe 3/10 of the capital. Now they're maybe supplying 2/10 of the capital. And the balance is being filled by more equity. And so mezzanine effectively lies, you know, one level above equity. Okay, and so what KKR does is they go out, they go to the banks, they try to get, you know, that 2/10 or 3/10 from the banks. Then they go out to various mezzanine sponsors that are out there, and they say, here's a transaction, here's what we're looking to buy, okay? Would you like to lend us money to actually, you know, fill in the gap here between our equity and the bank debt? And the guy who's got the mezzanine fund, he'll say, well, okay, I like the cash flow dynamics of this, you know, entity here that you're buying. Fine, I'll lend it to you, but the coupon is going to have to be between 10 to 12%. Then I want, you know, an extra layer of additional income in the form of, like, let's say, you know, additional bonds that the pick the payment in kind. And if they're still willing, they can probably take a small piece of the equity. So if the, you know, if the transaction does enormously well, then your mezzanine security gets a little bit of a kicker out of that equity piece. But generally, the bulk of the return is from that 10 to 12% coupon, the cash coupon that you collect.
Going back again, then we become part of the transaction.
Exactly.
It's a transaction, or it's they're going to do hundreds of transactions.
Not hundreds, but they'll do a series of maybe, you know, 8 to 20 transactions.
Okay, so they do 8 or 20 transactions. We give them money during the year 2011. They do 8 transactions, whatever. They lock it in for 12 years. Now, does that change? Somebody pays it off, another one comes in, they go back and forth, or does that stay put for 12 years?
Well, they'll do, first of all, though, they have an investment period written in their memorandum of 5-6 years. So they'll do those 8 to 20 transactions over the first 5 or 6 years of the fund. So it might, depending on the environment, they might do 6 this year, and 3 the next year, and whatever.
Right.
And I guess if one of their transactions where they lend money to a private equity fund or whatever to buy a company, if that gets callable, that would get callable.
Yeah, that would let's say, for instance,
3 years from now.
Yeah, if you know, you've got a non-call feature in place. Okay, the non-call feature expires, And obviously 10 to 12%, I mean, those are fairly high rates to be paying, especially in the current environment. Let's say the company is doing really well. The company wants to refinance that debt out. They can easily refinance that debt out. You'd get back your principal and obviously the income that you've collected. And depending on what the legals are in here, the company or the partnership could have the right over the first, during the investment period, to actually recycle the capital. So they can effectively call that capital back and reinvest it during, say, the first 4 or 5 years of the fund. Right.
But it wouldn't happen a lot of times. It'd be like one or two.
Right. Should it?
Right.
Okay,
right.
Now, kind of like my insurance guy, when I sign up for insurance, every year I renew insurance, he makes a commission every year. So these guys are paid 1% off the top of everything we invested every year, even though they made the transaction, which could last 10, 12 years.
So they get paid more. They get paid 1.5 off the top during their investment period, which is that first 5 to 6 year period.
Right.
And then it slides down to 1.25% to, I think it was year 10. And after year 10, if they extend the fund, then it's down to 1% management.
Okay, well, they're earning at least 1% every year, each year,
yes,
for the transaction they
plus
set up.
They have a performance-based fee. If they return to their LPs, i.e., Stan, Sarah, whoever their other investors are, a 8% preferred return on an annual basis, anything above 8%, they share a 20% performance fee. So if they're returning us 10% every year just on the coupons, that first 8% is all ours. That 2% above 8%, they're taking 20% or 0.4%, and we're getting 1.6%.
And we're essentially locking in the mezzanine structure a fixed amount, in other words, a fixed rate. We're taking a longer-term investment, a lower grade to get a higher yield.
Yes.
And locking it in for a long period of time, and they're getting a fee each year for what we've done.
That's right. And,
jeez.
Sorry. The investment quality, as they termed it, was kind of that B flat, is what they said. Was
right.
Right.
And the alternative to this would be for us to buy a B flat bond or something, which wouldn't be as high.
If you bought a high yield B flat bond in the market, you would be getting a lower coupon,
right?
Because it's liquid and it's in the public markets, and you would be subjected to higher volatility.
Okay.
Now, the trade-off.
Can you go into this complicated tax issue in question?
Part of what they might put leverage on some of the deals that they do, and if you're using leverage to create income, that gets in the area where UBTI is produced, and that has tax implications, I should say.
So to protect themselves, they're forming individual partnerships. Each group that we enter into or whatever is a separate partnership. Each individual partnership then can create its own tax reporting structure, whatever it needs to do to be able to report that.
As you'll be a partner in this fund,
and it'll spin off that information.
And you'll get some partnership returns or agreements, mm-hmm. right, on a tax basis that needs to be
flowed through the income statement or whatever we're doing.
And frankly, we don't have the ability to advise you on the tax implications.
Right.
That, and we bring that up in the memo. It's something that. And especially for this fund being the first type of investment in this area, I think, you know, for example, San Joaquin, another client of mine, does these type of agreements.
Right.
And they have a separate outside legal counsel advising them as they do the contracts on each of these deals, because it's fairly unique and somewhat complicated, is my sense. And they'll go through all the terms and issues, this gentleman who represents San Joaquin, on protecting their interests as best as you can and advising them on all the tax consequences.
So Paul, now the individual partnerships themselves then are standalone partnerships where they do well, file bankruptcy, whatever they do as individual partnerships, and we're part of that partnership.
You're part of the you're part of the fund partnership.
So as we enter into this, which is a higher risk investment, some may go bad, may file bankruptcy. A lot of them will succeed.
And then, you know, those none of them should go bankrupt. But
you don't want them to go. Well, I mean, if one.
Well, we don't want them to. Right. But I'm saying
there's that possibility.
Yeah,
might
you're
happen.
Taking a higher risk to get a higher return.
Yes.
And so there is the option of that possibility.
Yes.
And they protected themselves through the partnership structures. I mean, the only reason I can see you create all these multiple partnerships is that they, as an organization, can have, you know, hundreds of individual partnerships, one of which goes bad, it doesn't affect too much. And if we're a fund in groups, we could be in the same position.
I don't think they have hundreds of partnerships. For each fund, they'll have a single partnership. Off of that fund, they might have investors that have their own partnership because they're unique.
But the partnership structure allows that protection.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the reason you create it.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And they're also created. KKR themselves has tax benefits from that partnership.
Yes. Now, that's the other thing, is we really don't worry about the taxes as much as they do.
Right.
But they can protect themselves in the tax structure.
But I just want, if we go ahead and make an investment like this, I want someone to look at the implications from UBTI for the fund.
And Paul and Gordon, you should know that that Tom and I have spoken to tax counsel and have looked at what the costs would be of retaining tax counsel to advise the board.
What are we into?
Yeah, and what we did initially when Paul brought it up in the email to us that there were potential tax consequences as well as legal, we forwarded it to Fred Silva and also to our tax counsel that we normally use, which is Bob Blum of Hanson and Bridget. Now, he has advised us on IRS issues as they apply to how we pay out our benefits. However, he does not advise on investment, so he forwarded it to a partner in the firm of Hanson and Bridget by the name of Scott Smith. And again, he's another partner in the Hanson and Bridget law firm, and he has done many of these mezzanine debt deal reviews from a tax legal perspective. His charge is about $490 an hour, not cheap. He said most of these deals, the low is about $10,000, the high is about $20,000, and that's based on how much paper has to go back and forth, because he will actually review the 183 pages of the document, and he will give you an executive summary of what the deal is all about. He will also point out if he finds that there are some errors in it, something, and now he says KKR is a household name, so he doesn't anticipate a lot of problems with KKR per se, but they do a kind of a fine-tooth comb review of it and pull out if there are any errors or, you know, you didn't do this here, you didn't do that there, maybe you could tweak this. And they also would help with some kind of, you know, pushback of, well, you want to give us, you know, 7.5%, I think we need 8% or whatever. You know, they do something with that. And then depending on how much time, obviously, is spent, could go, again, bottom is about 10,000. Top he sees is about 20,000. I would anticipate this being our first one, or probably closer to 20 than 10. But it is based on an hourly $490 an hour. There are four other 1937 Act systems for which he's done business: Alameda, San Bernardino, Sonoma, and Sacramento. And I sent an email off to them earlier in the week to their chief investment officers. I haven't gotten a reply back yet as to, you know, how they like his services or whatever. But that's certainly a possibility for us to have that review done, to give the board some comfort with the documentation, to do, again, this executive summary of the documentation.
Can you speak about the leverage? Apparently they can also leverage this? You're saying 30% aggregate leverage or something?
It was 30 on one and 25 on the other one. Let me see what the mess.
That means that we put in, I don't know, $10 million. They can put us in a position where our interest is 30% higher?
Correct.
And again, that doesn't matter unless it would totally lost it.
The Mez Fund may use financial leverage in structuring its mezzanine investments on a selective case-by-case basis in an amount up to 25% of the aggregate capital commitments.
Okay.
for the MES, and I think infrastructure was 30%. So if they raise $1 billion, they could be up to $1.25 billion on a fund basis where each of the LP interests would be similar.
Highly unlikely, but that could require us to post additional capital if there were a problem. Is that what leverage does?
We've seen funds that, came out 2-3 years ago, right at the start of the financial crisis, that used leverage where that was the case, Gordon.
Okay. Yes.
Where investments went bad and they went back to their original investors seeking more capital.
But the limit there would be the 30%. So in other words, if we had $10 million, they couldn't ask us more than $3 million more.
If they asked you for $10 million, you put in $10 million, and things didn't go according to plan, you wouldn't have to put in anything more than above the $10
million. Oh, okay. So that $10 million doesn't commit us.
That $10 million could be completely lost.
Yeah.
And you might want to put in more just to
save it.
Right, but you're not obligated to put in more than your original capital commitment.
Okay.
That's correct, right?
To a certain extent, the investments are cross-collateralized. So if one investment is going sour, theoretically, they can try to sell off another investment in the fund to cover that shortfall. And also, depending on how the language is exactly written here, they can call additional capital.
Well, now, is there a possibility that if we're a small player, say 10% of the function, and the other players go bankrupt, that they could come back to us to cover their part?
Deep pockets? No. Do we have to pay for it?
Okay, that's trying to protect against
Every LP is individual in and of itself.
Okay. What is the weak key man clause, fee offset structure, and no fault clause?
The weakest link. That was in the infrastructure one, I believe. That is a point that we would like to go back to KKR and further discuss.
Because that kind of gives me that sinky feeling of the possibility of coming back at us somehow.
Right. And as you can see in our infrastructure memo, we're not advocating a commitment right away to KKR. In our mezzanine debt, we are. Obviously, some of the issues overlap from one fund to the other. But in the infrastructure, we did have investment concerns, alignment of interest it was under.
Yeah, generally speaking, it boils down to whether or not you want to make certain that the general partner, their interests are aligned with the limited partner. And when we talk about key man clause, effectively what we're talking about is, say, for instance, I believe the way the infrastructure agreement is written right now is it doesn't identify the one or two specific individuals who will be running the infrastructure partnership from the standpoint that if they were to get hit by the proverbial bus, what you would want to happen, generally how these agreements are written, is if the one or two key partners, for whatever reason, leave the firm, for a variety of reasons, you would like to have the LPs have the ability to suspend the investment period of the fund. And then once the investment period is suspended, it's up to the general partner to come back and say, okay, we found an adequate replacement, and we'd like to have the LP advisory board and the balance of the LPs approve these new partners to effectively run the fund. If all the LPs agree, then the fund can restart. If they all disagree, or if they all do not agree, then you can effectively dissolve the fund, sell off the interests, and everyone can go their merry way. But effectively, you want that clause in there. You don't want it to just be covering, two or three individuals that really have no meaningful impact on the fund itself. I believe the way the current structure or the way the language is right now in the infrastructure fund, it doesn't cover the one or two folks individually. It covers, I think, one gentleman and then two other people in the aggregate, instead of just saying that, Mr. So-and-so is effectively the key man. We would like to see it written so that it actually specifies that one individual is the key man. So if anything happens to that one person or two people, then we would like to have the ability to suspend the fund the commitment period of the fund until things can be resolved.
So the legal contract we entered into to get into this investment is one that has to be reviewed then?
Well, that's partly what we would hope that, as Tom mentioned, whoever's reviewing that will come to that same conclusion that we had. And during that period, we and or the attorney would negotiate with the GP to make sure that things are changed to our liking.
So in the one case we got into, and I'm as guilty as anybody else, didn't understand the process, I remember Deidre, and you got into some months of misunderstanding, maybe that's a polite way of saying it, on contractual, what to review, what needs to review, who's qualified to review. She expressed concern that she wasn't. I don't know where we're putting our attorney, if we need another attorey.
That's what we just said. Yeah. We would have another attorney that has expertise in this.
I'm not sure if it's a tax attorney or if we need somebody else to review the legal.
Well, it sounds like the gentleman, Tom.
Scott Smith has done the mezzanine debt for sure, because we knew we were.
Right. So we're talking all specs, not just the tax aspect.
Right. Right.
Okay. So, Paul, you recommend that we proceed with the mezzanine.
What we're recommending, Mike, is we would recommend the adoption of Mix 4. Okay. We would recommend a $30 million verbal commitment with KKR pending contract review and agreement on that. We would recommend with Invesco keeping the dollar amount under management where it is now and working with them for a future date to increase that up to the 3% weight over time when market conditions improve. And we would recommend on the infrastructure for now no action with KKR or any other organization, but to allow us to go back with KKR and go over the areas of concern we have specifically with them, keeping in mind that their first closing now appears to be the end of September, so we have some time to do that, and to bring forth additional infrastructure funds for your to the board in short order.
Well, I have a question in terms of, because we've kind of touched a little bit on the fees, obviously.
Yes.
You reported out on the fees, and then a comment that Tom made about what the tax attorney said, that there's some wiggle room there in terms of negotiations, and I don't know how firm the...
Frankly, I don't think there's wiggle room on the management fee and the performance fee. There's wiggle room on some of the language in the PPM that we would have concerns on, that we would like to go to the GP, and there might be wiggle room there.
Why would we make a verbal commitment prior to the advice of the tax attorney?
Well, I think the verbal commitment sets the tax attorney to review the whole process.
For both infrastructure and mezzanine?
No, just mezzanine at this point, I said. But for any private fund, regardless of what it is, a verbal commitment with the words pending contract review by our tax legal counsel and satisfaction on that end.
They're not going to send you proprietary contract language without a verbal commitment.
And a verbal commitment pending what we're saying.
Correct.
If the pending doesn't get satisfied, you don't make that commitment.
Correct.
You have an out.
That's pretty standard, right, Herschel? Yeah.
It means we're serious.
And then your final comment that when it's the most optimum time to do it would be to start building up the capital now and put it into cash.
No, I think we have. I prefer capital commitments are given. You have some notice on capital commitments.
10 business days.
Which you had mentioned about pulling it into cash.
If the board is really worried about equities and not wanting to leave it there, that that's an option. But I would prefer just to keep it where it is and use that as funding as we get capital calls.
All right.
Now, that said, before, after we make a capital commitment and have a contract signed, if we get to that point, the board will probably have to give authorization to staff and consultant to be able to raise those funds in right. case that happens in between board meetings.
Right.
We'll know where it's coming from.
Right. Will you start thinking about that too, where we should start pulling from?
Yes. I mean, we know what the allocations are, so we'll know. We'll drill down to the individual manager level and bring that back to you. Yes. Like I said, my sense is mezzanine debt will come from Dodge and Cox fixed income if MIX 4 is selected, and then we'll work on the other sources to fund Invesco and infrastructure as we get into that, if that occurs.
Earlier you said that they may have an additional capital call on this mezzanine debt. And when we put in our initial amount of money, would they could ask for additional?
It's unlikely, right?
Right. Is it possible, though? I mean, do they say we need another couple million more?
You mean if the underlying investments are going sideways because of the leverage? Yeah, theoretically, they're going to come back and say to cover this hole, we would like more capital because effectively you are the limited partner. So either they can go after, they can sell off the other investments in the portfolio, or they can go to the LPs and say, give us your pro rata share of the shortfall that we have in the fund.
Another thought that I had, and I don't know if the board wants to consider this or not, is like cost averaging as far as Invesco goes, since it is a mutual fund and we're just buying, shares, and if the price goes down over time and then all of a sudden jumps up, we kind of made out.
Yeah.
If they wanted to do like $1 million a month over 15 months or not. And I know our position now is to try to do things, lickety split, do it all, $30 million all at once or $15 million all at once. But if that's a thought where you want to,
I think maybe a combination, Tom, where down the road that Mesco comes to us and said things are looking better, that at that point we can decide whether to put the whole 15 or 5 of it or something like that.
Maybe that's a conversation to have with Invesco.
Yeah, exactly.
What our intention is and what we'd like to do.
I'll talk to Max.
I'd make that motion.
So you're making the motion to approve MIX number 4.
MIX number 4.
And with the
shortfall to KKR and MES and discussion with Invesco on another $15 million and the timing on that, and to further explore infrastructure to the tune of 39.
And this comes out of equities, right?
And fixed. Those new MIX 4, you can see all those categories moved down from where we are today.
This motion would commit us to the mezzanine debt. Would it absolutely commit us to increasing the Invesco real estate?
No.
That's pending.
I really have some reservations about that one.
No, there's no commitment to that right now.
Well, that's not really the motion.
Well, he's talking about immediately.
Well,
this is when the timing is correct. It basically increases our allocation, but not immediately.
Right. Well, we already have the 3% allocation or 2.5%.
We could decide that the time is never right.
Two separate motions.
Sure.
Theoretically.
Right. Theoretically, that's right.
Well, it is. We've established basically the policy by going
yes.
with MIX number 4.
That's a policy.
And just like we do anything else, we fund that policy, if you will, accordingly. So I don't think there's necessarily a... Because we also said we'd invest more in special funds a long time ago, but we haven't.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the same thought process.
And actually, even if... And if MIX 4 is... approved, it would not change our current target portfolio weights because it's going to take some time to migrate from where we are to where we're going.
So at worst, we're in the same status as we are now.
Immediately we're in the same status as we are now.
So progressively
better or worse.
But to answer Jim's question, there's a subsequent vote to allocate more money to real estate.
We will come back to you with the infrastructure in the real estate,
as a separate vote.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, so just because this is an increase.
Jim, we are changing the mix structure, so it does say that's where we're headed, but until we
exactly
actually
we get another chance to vote on.
Yes.
On that.
Yes.
Okay, so answer to your question, yes. So we have the motion.
I would second the motion on mix four because I think equities are dangerous and that reduces equities.
Well, I need Fred's help on this. For example, okay, so for 6A discussion and action on Invesco, no action taken. 6B, adopt the mix four with mezzanine, with the verbal. The verbal commitment to KKR, pending contract review and satisfaction, and then on the infrastructure, C would be no action.
Right.
Paul to
know. See, I don't see it like that. I see that we've made. I think we need to start with the
mix
the
four.
Board, whatever we decide.
Right.
Went with mix four, which includes investment presently or immediate plan is to fund the mezzanine. Future discussion to come on the infrastructure funding and real estate funding.
Additional funding.
But the way the format of this is
You need separate votes for one.
For A and C, we have changed the mix, so we can say adopted mix four on both A and C, I believe.
You can.
Right.
You can do it that way.
Or.
Because that has changed everything.
I think we show it just under ABC, all the three items were discussed. And then the following recommendations were made to adopt mix four, to verbally go $30 million with mezzanine debt, to further have conversations with Invesco on real estate investments, and then to look further into infrastructure.
Tom, one question.
That's
on
it.
Mix
if
four.
We can do that,
I think we also then need another motion to authorize you to hire counsel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can we do that as part of this
petition? No, you can do it as a separate motion.
One question, Tom. Just as in the real estate issue, on the mezzanine debt, right now it's zero, and we go to under mix four to three, that will come back to us for another vote and review also.
Yes.
So no actual money goes anywhere without more voting from us.
Except the verbal commitment.
It's a verbal commitment of $30 million pending the attorney tax... Consultant.
I seconded the motion on mix four.
Yeah, so I guess we would approve legal counsel's, tax legal counsel's recommendation.
Right.
Yes. So that's where the vote would come in later.
Yes, that's when the next vote would come, I guess.
Okay, so let's go back to the. So interesting. Let's see, under six, what we could list A, B, and C, and then would be who was the made the first motion?
It was Ron.
Ron.
Seconded by Mike Lynch. To adopt mix four with a verbal commitment to KKR on mezzanine debt pending contract review and satisfaction. I had written down what Paul had said, keep Invesco as is and increase to 3% over time, but then I heard some other verbiage. So
discussion with Invesco.
But keep Invesco as is and increase to 3% over time with conversation with
discussion.
With discussion.
And board approval.
Right.
And board approval.
Which one is he missing?
Okay. All right.
And further investigation on infrastructure. So no action on infrastructure.
But you want that written down?
Information, yeah.
And further info on infrastructure. Okay, so we got a first and a second.
Do we have any?
We need a roll call, but remember, we're audio recording, so no raising hands.
Well, do we have any further discussion than what we already have?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you want to do a roll call vote?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to do it?
Okay.
Let's see who's here.
You're the
note taker. Okay. Let's see here. Roll call yes for this. Gordon Ford?
No.
Mike Lynch?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Darren Garrett?
Yes.
Linda Stotts Burnett?
Yes.
Maria DeAnda?
Yes.
And Ron Martin?
Yes. Motion carried. At the next meeting, you want to bring back a 30% commitment to 90-day treasuries. Is that kind of where you want to go?
That's kind of risky.
About 30 days.
It's the U.S. government, right?
Okay. Fred, on the question of legal counsel for tax purposes, since we don't have it on the agenda, I mean, is this something that we can vote on?
I think so, because I think it goes a long way.
It's part of the overall discussion.
Do we need a mark and give his administrative instruction?
And it's mentioned on one of the handouts.
I would rather follow council's advice and give administrator board approval to hire.
I move that administrator be given approval to seek appropriate tax and legal counsel on mezzanine and infrastructure investments.
And I'll second it.
Well said.
And for the purpose of reviewing the contract between Stansara and KKR as it relates to mezzanine debt.
Okay, wait, you guys.
See, now you messed up.
See, you give me all these.
It's on the recording.
Yeah.
Administrative. Mike, what did you say?
You can't remember.
You wanted administrative.
he's making a motion.
I move that we approve the administrator. Seeking legal and tax counsel regarding Stansara's potential mezzanine and infrastructure investments.
Thank you. First and a second.
Yeah.
Mike Lynch and Linda Stutz-Burnett.
Yeah. Yes, no. Okay. Next step. I got
just any further discussion? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved. Thank you. Next, we go into closed session. Kelly or Tommy, report out.
On item 7D, motion was made by Mike Lynch and seconded by Ron Martin to accept the hearing officer's recommendation to deny Rex R. Klein Jr.'s application for a service-connected disability retirement benefit. On item 7E, motion was made by Darren Garrett and seconded by Ron Martin to authorize the retirement administrator to provide a counterproposal to the interested party or its agents and allow the retirement administrator to use the counterproposal for other interested parties. Motion carried, unanimous on both 7D and 7E.
Thank you. That takes us to members' forum. So
nothing.
Okay.
I'll be here next week.
Pass. I have an item. I've talked about this before to some, and I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, when we do the agenda and we have a consent, the people who are retiring, I think we should have, after the retirement date, two figures. One is the base salary, and the other would be final compensation for salary for pension purposes. And this became particularly clear to me in the meeting with the actuaries when we were talking about what they said, that virtually everybody, 100% of senior management, you know, take full advantage of the 29-day kick-up on vacation, and nobody's been contributing to the system on that at all, either the employer or the employee. So that's a cost that's totally absorbed by the system. And I think that when these items come before us, and I don't dispute the county or the employee groups making agreements however they want. I don't dispute any of that. But I think part of our responsibility is to understand the long-term cost implications. And I think that's an information item that we should know about. And so I would like the agendas to reflect that when these items come before us.
They also said that when you asked the question of why it hadn't been addressed in the past, it's because from an actuarial standpoint, when they reviewed it, it was a minimal to zero cost overall to the system when you factor in all the actuarial data. So that was also what they said.
I don't see how that could be.
Probably because
there's a margin of error elsewhere. So, but if you haven't contributed for 20 or 30 years at that spiked amount, and you only contribute in the final year, that amount hasn't been accrued for, in essence.
Yeah, but I think what they're saying is when you're looking at the total system and you're looking at all annuities, I think is what they're saying.
But they didn't want to add a small amount because of it, so it had some value.
2%. Well, if we adopt it, correct. You're right.
Yeah, but I mean, they had some figure calculating
right.
it.
Right.
But if it's 100% of management, what percentage of rank and file is it?
They're not allowed as much.
They're not allowed as much.
I think they gave it, I forget what it was. It was in the 70s, I thought. But the important thing for me isn't, I mean, I think some of these people deserve to have that extra or that kick up, however you want to call it. I'm not disputing the county or the employee association or the board of supervisors' right to do that for somebody. I think that's their right. I think it's our right, though, to know what all of this is. And that's what my motion is, simply an issue to provide more transparency to the system so that, you know, if we had looked for 3 years at these and we saw every single one was a 15, 20% markup, one of us would have said, what the heck's going on? You know, and one of the board members, Jim or somebody, would have said over there, what the heck's going on? And this is just part of full disclosure and transparency. Your retirement right now is on the websites. That was all made available to the paper. And all the county salaries are on the BEES database site, you know, and on a matter of public record. So there's no issue.
I don't think the county would have objected because they've approved final compensations that have increased senior management executive salaries by about $40,000 a year.
Darren, what I'm saying is let's shed light on that whole practice. That's what I'm saying.
Is the information available?
Yeah, the information is available, and I guess it's up to, I mean, normally in members forum we just say for future agenda items, so we could put this on the August 24th meeting if you want to discuss it and move forward with that, because the next consent item wouldn't come out till September 8th anyways. So we can put it on the agenda item and the board can fully discuss it. I know there's some members not here.
Can you give us something that would be a markup or something to show us what we're talking about?
Sure.
Some idea of something.
I don't think it counts. How you do it.
Anyway, that was my item. I want to pursue that. And Tom was very gracious in putting up with my emails over the past few weeks. So.
Well, and that you know, we don't want to obviously be the point or the political football or whatever, and you know, say, oh, okay, we can go to the retirement system and tell them to stop doing this. It's like, we can't stop doing it.
No, I agree, and I think that should be, we can make that very clear.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's.
Well, to me, in my mind, I think the easiest thing to do, since we already have a petition that's been filed, we have. That petition has now been adjudicated. The board has already made a decision that we were not going to pursue any further legal proceedings on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the cleanest way to do it, and maybe this is where you're going, I think we just say, here's the name, here's what the retirement amount is going to be on an annual basis. We already know that's the court has ruled on that. In my opinion, you know, to come to, you know, that figure, if someone wants to know, you know, you can come down and, you know, you can, you know, maybe figure it out yourself by going to the website and everything. But from the retirement system's position, we already have a legal ruling from a judge of original jurisdiction that has ruled and said this information is public. Mm-hmm. And I think to say, well, here's what their one salary was, here's what this, pretty soon you're going to have three numbers on there. And it's just going to, in my opinion, compound to say, you know what, we're going to add this in the betterment of transparency in government. Boom. Here's what their annual annuity is.
That's a good point.
It's done. It's just kind of a furtherance of what we've already been instructed to do by the court.
I would just encourage that anything like that be put in context in terms of whether it's final salary, years of service, because if you put out these numbers just there, it doesn't tell the whole story. And that's what I'm concerned about. And the other thing, well, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but you and I are county employees. I don't necessarily want this. If somebody wants to come up here and ask and get it, that's their business. But to basically put it out there in a public document like that, it's like, this is how much this person is making when they leave their position. You know what? Pretty much, unless you're a really busybody, nosy person, I don't think you need to know.
Well, but that's why I'm saying...
In case I have bill collectors.
No. No, but what I'm saying, Maria, is to make it cleaner. We already have a ruling by a court saying that this is all public information. This association has already released the entire list as of that date of all our current annuitants and broken it down. So in my mind, it's either, you know, we can do this on a monthly basis, or, you know, we can say we're going to release a list. You know, I agree with you that, and Mike, chime in here, but I agree that if you put multiple figures out there, you know, that, in my mind, that's a county issue. What their final average compensation is at the county, that's for the county to release that information. The information that we have been told to release by the court, and counsel chime in, has been, here's what their annual retirement payment is. The court was very clear on that. So as far as I'm concerned, the final average compensation or what the compensation was a year or 2 years ago, if they want that information, they need to take it up with county personnel. Am I right?
You're right, but I think since this item was not on the agenda, I really think that we probably ought to stop the discussion now and put it on the agenda so we can have a notice meeting and we can discuss it then.
Sure. Okay.
Get carried away.
Yeah.
Good. So that was my item. Anytime you'll bring us something simple, let us know, you know?
I have nothing.
Nothing.
Okay. More for me.
Michelle, anything? Okay, nothing for me. So, I think this meeting is done.